From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the pages of The Atlantic Monthly in an essay from a billionaire venture capitalist named Nick Hanauer. The piece is titled, Better Schools Won't Fix America. It's gone viral enough that even former President Barack Obama tweeted this week, quote, this is worth a read, a thought-provoking reminder that education reform isn't a cure-all. As a supporter of education reform myself, I agree that fixing educational inequality requires doing more to address the broader systemic sources of economic inequality, end quote. Now, Hanauer writes that the most radical school reforms are still not able to overcome the crippling impact of economic inequality in this country. I'm going to quote him now at length so you've got a good sense for the arguments he's making, and then we'll have a robust conversation about them. He writes, quote, long ago, I was captivated by a seductively intuitive idea, one many of my wealthy friends still subscribe to, that both poverty and rising inequality are largely consequences of America's failing education system. Fix that, I believed, and we could cure what ails America. This belief system, which I have come to think of as educationism, is grounded in a familiar story about cause and effect. Once upon a time, America created a public education system that was the envy of the modern world. But then sometime around the 1970s, America lost its way. We allowed our schools to crumble and our test scores and graduation rates to fall. And as inequality increased, so did political polarization, cynicism, and anger, threatening to undermine American democracy itself. Taken with this storyline, I embrace education as both a philanthropic cause and a civic mission. I co-founded the League of Education Voters, a nonprofit dedicated to improving public education. I joined Bill Gates, Alice Walton, and Paul Allen in giving more than $1 million each to an effort to pass a ballot measure that established Washington State's first charter schools. All told, I have devoted countless hours and millions of dollars to the simple idea that if we improved our schools, if we modernized our curricula and our teaching methods, rooted out bad teachers, and opened enough charter schools, American children, especially those in low-income and working-class communities, would start learning again. But after decades of organizing and giving, I have come to the uncomfortable conclusion that I was wrong. What I've realized decades late is that educationism is tragically misguided. American workers are struggling in large part because they are underpaid, and they are underpaid because 40 years of trickle-down policies have rigged the economy in favor of wealthy people like me. To be clear, we should do everything we can to improve our public schools, but our education system can't compensate for the ways our economic system is failing Americans. Even the most thoughtful and well-intentioned school reform program can't improve educational outcomes if it ignores the single greatest driver of student achievement, household income, end quote. And Hanauer concludes, quote, we have confused a symptom, educational inequality, with the underlying disease, economic inequality. Here in Rochester, there is heated debate about a possible state takeover of the city school board. There are conversations about many other reforms, and Hanauer is saying it really doesn't matter. If you don't fix poverty first, you really can't fix schools, not entirely. Is he right? Our guests this hour are going to discuss it. They include Erica Rosenberg, president and CEO, just announced, of the Center for Governmental Research. Congratulations on that. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much.
Also with us is Joe Klein, chairman of Klein Steel and an advocate for education reform for a long time here in Rochester. Joe, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
Mercedes Phelan is here, an organizer at Citizen Action of New York. Mercedes, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you so much.
And Bruce Popper is a former vice president of 1199 SEIU and a member of the RMAPI Steering Committee. Bruce, welcome to you. Thanks for being here. Don't make me yell at you. Bruce, get on your microphone. I just told you. I appreciate you all being here, and there's a lot to talk about. I want to start with just some general reactions to the piece itself, and we'll go around the room with that. I'll start with Erica Rosenberg. Go ahead, Erica.
Thanks, Evan. I think there is a lot to be said for the arguments that are made in this piece. I guess I would a little bit reject the framing that it's an either-or, right? Either we improve schools or we do something about inequality in our economy. I think those are two giant problems that we all need to be working on at the same time, not to be too Pollyanna about it or sound too corporate about it, saying it's not an either or, it's a both and, but I really do believe that. I mean, certainly in the work that I have done going back years to when I was an education reporter at the Democrat and Chronicle and covering city schools, it was clear back then, which is 20 plus years ago, that income and mother's level of education were really the key variables in school performance and student performance, and that hasn't changed. And I think we can look across the country and see that there really is no high-performing, that I know of, urban district that is loaded up with poor students. We just haven't cracked that problem at scale. So I find a lot of things in this article to be persuasive. And while I certainly wouldn't say, you know, school reform doesn't matter, school reform does matter. I would also say that income inequality has emerged as a bigger problem, you know, in the last 20 years, for sure.
Okay, Mercedes Phelan.
Yeah, so similar to Erica, I don't think it's a either or, but I think an important part that was really missing from this article was the racial inequality piece to it. I think that we need to talk about the whole child, that would include their parents, their families, et cetera, and really the core issues. Because even if we fix the economic part, that within itself would be really hard to do because you're still not addressing the racial issues.
Okay. Joe Klein.
His contention is that multiple studies show that only 20% of school effectiveness is because of school. 60% is the family. And I've never seen any study that said that. And I've been in this 14 years and have read thousands of studies. There are studies that show that opioids aren't addicting, funded by the Sackler family, that sugar doesn't cause obesity, funded by the soda pop industry. If you look at Rochester, and because of CGR, when I was a board member, I helped recruit and start Rochester Prep. Next year, there'll be 2,500 students. These kids, over 90%, come from impoverished homes. They will start in kindergarten. The vast majority of them will go on to four-year colleges. They will break the cycle of poverty. And now you're talking, you know, scale, 2,500 kids. You look at Virtus, which I helped recruit.
Help start.
Those boys, you know, 300 boys start in ninth grade, virtually all free and reduced lunch. They were headed towards the street corner. That was their best option, a lot of them. Not all, but a lot of them. Instead, on half the money of the district, those kids are going to go to MCC and not remedial, right into MCC, four-year colleges, get well-paying jobs, or maybe go to the military. Same kids, but we've created alternate public schools that are better. If you look at the number of jobs, well-paying jobs with good benefits, there are thousands of them available in Rochester. I'm on the board of the RTMA. We all sit at meetings and say, how can we get people who can, you know, read, write, and do math? We'll do the training. It is our school district that is deliberately not teaching those kids to read, write, and do math.
What do you mean deliberately? I mean, you really deliberately?
Okay, so I'll tell you what I spent 3 years in the district. We got school 52 to the best reading results. We beat the selective school 58. The district took a meat cleaver to our program. We had a great summer school reading program. The kids loved it. District stopped doing the busing. That's all it cost them, the busing. They started taking away our staff. They took away our reading coordinator, saying, you don't need it. We had our best teachers punished by the union reps.
There's a lot there. But the point, I think, and I want to hear from Bruce to get his over, and then we'll kind of get right into it here. But Joe, I guess the point that you're trying to raise here is that you believe that despite, and there is plenty of data that suggests life outcome, future income is tied to zip code. I mean, there's a lot right?
Absolutely.
Okay, so that data does exist. Absolutely. You're saying that can be overcome simply by changing the way we teach and the way we create schools.
Is being overcome at scale in Rochester.
Okay, Bruce Popper, go ahead.
I had just finished a memo
an internal memo about the importance of fighting poverty through raising the wages of tens of thousands of low-wage healthcare workers in the area when my political director, Larry Knox, came up and said, I just found this article overnight. That's what you've been talking about for years. I've been involved with the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative now for 4 years, and at its outset, there was a visit sponsored by the Rochester Business Journal of Peter Edelman, the husband of Marion Wright Edelman of the Children's Defense Fund and a professor at Georgetown, in which Edelman laid out about 10 different reasons for poverty in America, the number one reason being low wages. Yes, family issues, mass incarceration, racial issues, homelessness, these are all dimensions of poverty, but most poor people work. And I really related to Hanauer's statement that we're mixing cause and effect here. The cause of failing schools, city after city after city after city, who are profiles of concentrated poverty and housing segregation along racial and income lines with failing school districts, should suggest that it's not about a new program, a new superintendent, a different school board. This is endemic of areas with concentrated poverty. And Monroe County happens to be the home of where the Supreme Court institutionalized housing segregation, as you know, in the Worth versus Selden case in the 1970s. So it is not a surprise that we have a failing school district, and there are experiments and partnerships and programs that do make a difference. But the 800-pound gorilla in the room is until we correct the income of the mass of working poor people, we will never solve the school district problem.
Mercedes, I know there were some things you wanted to respond to. Go ahead.
You can come back to me.
It's okay. Well, then let me hit a couple of things because you know, Joe raised a number of points here. And I'm going to hit the question of jobs here, because what you talk about are the kinds of jobs that you want to see kids aspire to, that you think are out there. Hanauer writes in the piece that the most available jobs, the largest growing sectors in our country, just don't pay very well. I'm going to quote from his piece. According to federal estimates, 4 of the 5 occupational categories projected to add the most jobs to the economy over the next 5 years are among the lowest paying jobs. Food prep and serving, 19,000 average earnings, average annual earnings. Personal care and service, 21,000. Sales and related, 25,000. Healthcare support, 26,400. What he's saying is, yes, there are jobs at Klein Steel. There are jobs at certain manufacturers in tech, but there aren't enough to employ everyone in a society that is growing with 330 million people. And if we have enough people in the kind of job sectors that he just talked about there, we're in real trouble. And that if you don't raise wages, we're not going to see a change. Do you agree or disagree?
Well, I agree with that.
You do agree with that. Okay.
You know, I absolutely believe that you know, a living wage is something that the country has to go towards and fight for that. But at the same time, there are thousands and thousands of pretty good-paying jobs in Rochester, and we don't have people who can read, write, and do math who can fill those jobs.
So the other question that, listening to your comments, I want to follow up with, and then I'll let the whole panel I'll just leave the room, and you guys tell me when the hour is over, is, you know, Joe, I hear in you a real belief that despite crippling inequality and poverty, the right kind of schools and teaching can overcome that. And you're saying that, you're seeing that, right?
Go to Brooks Avenue or J Street. You can see it yourself.
So what I want to know is, is it just a coincidence that in this country, the worst, in your view, the worst schools and the worst teaching happen to be in the places where there's also poverty?
I don't think it's a coincidence. I think there are absolutely some structural racism. As Bruce pointed out, housing patterns, starting here, have been abusive. However, there are some districts, as you know from David Osborne, who, if you look at New Orleans, which is now all charter, it is the only district in the country where the kids in the city are outperforming the kids in the state in graduation and readiness. And one of the neat things, you could say, well, Louisiana, their educational standards are in the sewer, which they are, but the standards themselves are rapidly improving. You can see some other cities where you're making some progress. Newark, even despite the book, the prize, those kids are doing so much better academically than they were 10 years ago. Camden, New Jersey is doing much better. Washington, D.C., second fastest growing academic results in the country. It's now half charter schools. And the problem with Washington and some of the other cities, gentrification. You put in the same with Seattle. You start great charter schools, and what's going to happen is people without means are just going to be pushed out and they're going to have an hour commute. That won't happen in Rochester. Our city was built for 350,000 people. We have, what, maybe 210,000, something like that. We can have great schools and actually have a vibrant, integrated culture without having to gentrify anyone out. If, A, we could fix the city school district, and all you have to do is read Dr. Aquino's report, read the Attorney General's report on Trevion, read the controller's report. I mean, those things are an indictment.
Okay.
So,
go ahead, Mercedes.
I'm wondering where you got that information from, because from Newark, New Jersey, the system, when charter schools took over, it's actually, the system has stayed actually the same as it was beforehand. So I'm not sure where you're getting that information from.
Right. That you can look at NAEP scores. NAEP is the National Assessment of Educational Progress. It is the gold standard of educational performance, as Erica could tell you, and you can look at NAEP scores. What David Osborne said when he was here was most of the data that is put out by the National Teachers Union is false.
Yeah, this wasn't the National Teachers Union.
Okay, well, the National Assessment of Educational Progress is where you would want, and it is the gold standard. It's a non, no one, what's the word I want?
I'm not sure.
So
okay, but that's the gold standard. That's where you would get the data from.
But Evan,
the other.
Go ahead, Mercedes. You can conclude the point.
Yeah. No. The other part I was going to say just about the charter schools is we only have a couple right now in Rochester, correct? But the
20% of the kids.
Right, and the ones that we do have actually have the highest suspension rates throughout out of the entire district.
Actually, last study that was done showed that the kids leave school at the same percentage that the kids in district schools.
Suspension rate is much.
I apologize.
It's okay. It's much higher, and so really, what's happening is, you know, in charter schools currently, you get to pick and choose what children come in and out.
Absolutely not. It's done by lottery.
What do you mean it's done by lottery?
If it's oversubscribed, they do a lottery to determine
right.
who
kids
to
get
admit.
To like. Opt to try to get into
correct.
The school.
Parents
correct.
Have, parents
yes.
and
okay.
families
right.
have to.
But you're not in the lottery if the parents don't choose to put you in the lottery.
That's right.
Right.
That's
right. Okay, but then somebody, right, makes a decision on which students come in and which students don't, right?
But we market in the catchment areas with the highest poverty rates.
No, they don't actually make a decision. If it's random. I mean, if it's a lottery, if the school is oversubscribed, it's not picking applicants that you selectively reject.
So,
I'm not trying to discredit your whole point, I just want to make that clarification.
So, and then once the students are in, let's say they throw a chair, let's say they break something, whatever, and then they're suspended, right?
Do you get
where I'm going?
Okay, you're suspended for violence. Yes.
Okay, so right now you have that.
I think that the suspension rates in the district, you can't believe any of their data. But if you look at the kids who just don't show up at the district, I think it would be hard to really compare suspension rates in charters with the suspension rates in the district, since so many kids in the district just don't show up.
I mean, there's clear data that shows the difference
yes.
between the two.
Between suspension
and
rates.
And suspension rates are much
yes.
higher in,
yes.
in charter schools. And what I'm saying is when you no longer, and not only suspensions, but then, so then those kids, if they're either suspended or kicked out, then they're going back to the district or they're going somewhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you have that option right now of kicking a child out and they, wherever they go, they get to go.
Well,
okay. But if the whole system...
suspension isn't kicking a child out, though.
Okay, but I'm saying...
It's a little different than expulsion.
Okay, expulsion. If you... Which does happen.
And I don't know to the extent that charter schools do that or even allowed to do that.
And Mercedes...
I mean, I've seen it happen, but when it does happen, then that kid is going back into the school district or wherever, right?
Right?
So right now there's an option.
Well, no,
for
only if
for those children to go
if
somewhere
they're expelled,
else.
Not suspended. But remember, about 2-3 years ago, mm-hmm. 55,000 student days of suspension in the district. I mean, we're talking pretty heavy.
In the last 2 years, suspension's gone down by 44% in the district.
Right.
Yeah. So it's improved in the district, but not at charter schools.
Evan, I want to go back to your point, though, about zip code. I'm a big fan of the charts that occur weekly in the Rochester Business Journal. And if you take the chart on school performance and the chart of household income, mm-hmm. you come up with an incredibly clear correlation that the number one factor in school performance is less program, charter, non-charter, all that kind of stuff, as household income. And one of the things that's not in Nick Hanauer's article, he talks about himself and Bill Gates, Paul Allen, the Seattle billionaire group, right? After Hanauer concluded that this wasn't working, he partnered with David Rolfe, one of the inventors of the Fight for 15. And he was instrumental in the implementation of bringing the business community in Seattle and in Washington State together with Rolfe to implement the $15 minimum wage, which also pushed up. When it becomes a minimum, you're also getting what's called wage compression. In other words, other mid-level jobs go up as well. There are still some issues in Seattle, including rent inflation and transportation and things like that. But clearly, Hanauer looked at what he put in this article about 40 years of wage stagnation. Edelman said 4 years ago that the average wage in America had gone down to $35,000 and that half the workforce was below that. $35,000, according to our MAPI, is not a self-sufficient wage in Monroe County. And that's now the national average, and that is clearly the average in Monroe County. So again, the big issue here is the correlation between income, poverty, and school performance. And as we have these bifurcated school districts, right, every town with its own school district, or in some cases multiple, and we have one district for the inner cities, Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, Yonkers, et cetera, it is no coincidence that the performance levels and the pressures on these kids, right, cause failed and failing school districts primarily because of household income.
Erica, you've heard a lot of data, and you're a data person. It's why you're here. What's the most compelling to you?
All of it. I guess what I've been thinking about is the fact that education, income, and race are all variables that matter to everything we're discussing and are completely, hopelessly conflated. And I don't think there is a way to tease out one from the other and say this or that is the key and the most important thing to focus on. So I just wanted to chime in a little bit on the charter school question. My perspective is charter schools are not all good or all bad. You have very good charter schools
Absolutely.
That are doing wonderful things with children that may well have not succeeded, and you have other charter schools that are more mediocre, and you have charter schools that are really bad. And of course, the promise of charter schools is that the bad ones will not be renewed at some point. And I think in New York State, we have a decent track record of poor charter schools being shut down. So I think that charter schools are important, but I don't think it's the key issue. And there are, I want to acknowledge Mercedes' points, too. There are certainly some risks with the charter schools as well. And I wouldn't want to overinterpret, you know, positive results, even from several schools. And I'm not sure that Rochester is going to be a place that, you know, there was a hurricane in New Orleans, right? And you kind of wiped out the school district. And I don't know as many details about that as you do, Joe, but you know, it was built back up with all charter schools.
With an increase of funding of about 15%, yeah. You know, a big surge in extra funding.
I mean, we're not getting
those are just facts.
We're not getting a hurricane in Rochester, right? I mean, there's not going to be something that wipes out what we have now, you know, even despite the fact that people really might want to see that happen. And, you know, I guess I'll make one other point. I've been, you know, watching the Rochester School District very closely now for 25 years, and all the problems have remained exactly the same, and all the people have changed, and the standards have changed, and the tests have changed, which says to me that the problem is structural, right? It's not necessarily, and I'm not trying to discredit anything you said, Joe, about the management problems that you saw there. But I guess over the time I've been watching, I've given up the idea that it's a poor management problem.
Okay, and so on the subject of a state takeover, there's something that didn't occur to me to ever ask, but I think it's a fair question. So I'm going to ask Joe, because I know, Joe, this is something that you do support.
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
We've talked about that. Who is responsible, you think, for the level of poverty in Rochester? Who's the most to blame?
The Rochester City School District. If you look, why is Rochester, for a city our size, highest concentrated level of youth poverty? Nationally, I'm not sure Erica would know, we're fourth or fifth highest. It is the Rochester City School District. One of the funny things that Hilda Rosario Escher said was, if my girls go to Eugenio Maria to host a charter school, they go to college. If they go to, and she mm-hmm. named two city mm-hmm. schools, mm-hmm. they will get pregnant as teenagers and be poor. Mm. Hmm. I believe that it is the fault of the district. And if you read Dr. Aquino said, if no child in the district attended school except for the 2 days of state testing, the results would not be worse.
Okay, so hold on. So I just have a few other questions here. It sounds to me like we've got some people who want to jump in on that. But is city government at all to blame for poverty?
I don't know.
You don't know? Hold on a second. Joe Klein, you can say that you think the school district is most responsible, but there's no
that just
culpability.
Sounds like you have a resentment towards the district.
Okay,
let me play this out with Joe first.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. I guess because I've never really thought about it.
I'm going with this. If someone is culpable for poor educational outcomes and you want a state takeover, in a city that has also had structural poverty that hasn't changed, do you want a state takeover of city council and the mayor's office?
I do not believe, and I have been pretty focused on education.
Yeah.
I don't know that much about the city. I know when you look at housing patterns, you look at banking patterns, what we've done to keep people in poverty has been, I don't know that much about city government. My guess, no cities operate that well. I would not be in favor of a city takeover. I think if you look at certain of our businesses, there is some culpability as far as keeping poverty here.
But here's why I think that question's fair. For people who are upset with the performance of the Rochester City School Board, and I get it. I mean, you want to see better outcomes. To say, that's it. It's been long enough. We're going to have the state take over. I don't understand not also saying we want the state to take over city council and the mayor's office because we've got poverty at the same level, unless what Erica Rosenberg is saying is true, which is you can put different people in place, you can put different ideas. For 3 decades, we've seen plenty of different reforms and ideas at the city level, at the educational level. When you have a structural inequality that goes way back, that is built probably a lot on racism, on redlining, on economic dispossession, and it's pretty entrenched, it's hard to change it, isn't it? You think?
You can change it by putting in good schools, schools that will send kids to college. You can, you look at Roland Fryer's work at Harvard, and Harvard is...
But how is them going to a good school, how is that going to change their parents not making enough money? How is that going to change the fact that
Mercedes,
they're living in poverty
right.
and they're dealing with trauma on a daily basis?
It will not change their parents' situation. It will change the student situation. If you look at Roland Fryer's study at Ed Labs at Harvard, and Harvard is the best education policy in the country, he did a clever study with the Harlem Children's Zone and took the kids who were getting the full suite of services and going to the charter school and the kids just outside the boundary of getting the suite of services to see how those kids were doing. And he concluded that it was just the charter school. If you look at Perry Preschool, it was just on NPR, having just a great preschool changes poverty rates, job rates for two generations. So education can do it.
But not education alone.
Well, Hartford, Connecticut just had a... drop, that was the one that was worse than Rochester, I think, statistically. And the principal drivers of that were an increase in the Connecticut minimum wage and child care subsidies in the city. What caused Rochester poverty? That would be a couple-hour program, right? But let's do the lightning round, right? 1995, I was given by a DNC reporter a Harvard Kennedy Study School about downsizing in Rochester as Kodak was starting to implode, right? And the thesis in Brockelman, the author's name was Brockelman, was that Rochester's affluence was driven primarily by the manufacturing wage, mm-hmm. and that its service wage was remarkably below national and state averages, and it had a small governmental section. And unlike Buffalo, which government jobs replaced the manufacturing loss, Rochester didn't have that kind of cushion. And when Rochester eventually became one of the last Rust Belt cities to deindustrialize, the social dislocation in Rochester would be worse than Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Buffalo, Detroit, etc., right? I keep on going back to that in talks that I give because it's almost like a prophecy that this guy did back in 1995. Take that together with a great resistance to the unionization of service workers, healthcare, human services, and the new workforce, and you drop to a remarkably lower wage. In, I think it was the 2010 census, Monroe County was the only county that had a 10% drop in household income. Again, largely the change in the job market, the change in the economy. When you couple that economy and where poor people work, and a concentration based on housing segregation in the city of Rochester, you have all of the ingredients of a failed system, a failed city, a failed school district, yes. a failed economy, and an intense dislocation. Multiply that nationally, and you have fertile ground for the kind of racial and ethnic demagoguery that goes on with the present administration and the right wing of the Republican Party and others. I mean, Rochester is a microcosm of that, and the school district mm-hmm. is simply symptomatic of that. Yep. And that really is the story in Rochester poverty. It keeps on being driven by wages. I often use Jesse Jackson's 1988 speech to the Democratic National Convention, where he said that most poor people work. They drive dangerous cabs. They clean the hotel rooms that people stayed in last night. They work in hospitals and healthcare institutions, and they don't make a living wage. It's not about people collecting welfare checks or sitting around lazy. They're working jobs night and day and are away from their kids. That is the reality. What really was striking to me about this article is I have been in the room with foundation people around the poverty table, and yes, there is some discussion about wages, but it's almost like any other solution, transportation, education, counseling, personal mm-hmm. development, family stuff, are the approaches when the real cause here, the overwhelming cause, is people don't make enough in the jobs. We have to address the economy.
Well, we've got a lot of feedback from our audience to sort through, and we're going to do that after our only break of the hour. We're here because a lot of people have been talking about a piece in the Atlantic Monthly this week written by Nick Hanauer, the piece titled Better Schools Won't Fix America. If you want to check that out, we've got it posted on various platforms. You just heard Bruce Popper, who's a former vice president of 1199 SEIU and a member of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative Steering Committee. Mercedes Phelan is an organizer at Citizen Action of New York. Erica Rosenberg, president and CEO of the Center for Governmental Research, and Joe Klein, chairman of Klein Steel, advocate for education reform, and someone who's been working on these reform issues for decades now in this city. Let's get that only break of the hour, and we're right back to your phone calls and emails next. Coming up in our second hour, Governor Andrew Cuomo said it wasn't going to get done this session, but turns out, in the end, a climate action bill passed in Albany. And the advocates and the activists are celebrating. Now, they had to make some concessions. So next hour, we dig into exactly what this bill means. David Roberts, writing for Vox, says it is a very big deal. And New York State becomes a national leader in climate action. We'll talk about how next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It's too bad we didn't set aside both hours for this, based on your feedback. But let's get through as much as we can. Robert in Fairport. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. You know, one thing that nobody's mentioning here is the difference in family structure between the parts of the community that are doing well and the parts that are doing poorly. if you look at the percentage of single-parent families in the city of Rochester, what are you looking at? 60, 70, 80% of the family structure there is single family, single parent. There's no way, based on that family structure, that you're going to be prosperous. It's baked into the cake when you have a single-parent family unit that you got one leg of the stool to sit on, and you're not going to be as prosperous. So you're looking at poverty and all these other things. You got to talk family structure.
Robert, okay, thank you. Mercedes, go ahead.
Yeah, I want to jump in and disagree with that. I'm a single parent, and I live in the city, and I think that my child is just fine. I think she's going to be just fine. So I don't necessarily get where that's coming from.
If I can chime in too, I would disagree with that a little bit as well. I mean, the rates of single parent families in the suburbs are high as well. You know, it really varies across different racial groups, but I mean, I think nationally we've got like 30% of our kids are in single parent families, and they're not all poor. I mean, it certainly creates challenges when you don't have two parents involved, but people can live apart and both support their kids. And I think that, you know, that's one of those things that has been also a bit of a red herring. What's the policy prescription to fix if you diagnose the problem as single parenthood? What's the policy you know, there isn't one. So I think it's much more important to look at family function, how well families are functioning, whether the parents are together or not, and how we as a society support that functioning.
Joe Klein, what do you think of that?
Our initial group of Rochester Prep parents was virtually all single women. Within 3 years, we beat every city school. We beat suburban schools in math and English.
So you're not buying it?
I'm not buying it.
You're not buying it. Okay. Let's get back to your phone calls, and I'll go to Bonnie in Rochester next. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. First of all, I wanted to kind of support what Bruce has been saying about the income issue. I mean, it's almost, how could it not be just almost common sense? If wages, even though there's been some recent increases, you know, over a long period of time, is not getting to a level where, to a more middle-class level, there's got to be a lot of consequences to that. Anybody who interacts with people who are poor or themselves have had times when they're poor, when you're poor, the daily routine of having to deal with these issues, I don't think we understand sometimes what that really means. So, of course, that's an issue. And the city's been too busy trying to figure out how to get more high-end investments downtown rather than considering the people's needs in the neighborhoods. Having said that, the thing that I also have not heard, maybe I came in later in this, is that any service need, whether it be education, health, has to have a way to have an organized group of people who receive that service. So in the case of schools, it's parents. And there's been efforts to try to do some of that, but they are not effective because you have to have people who really know how to organize and believe in empowering people, not just, you know, I answered your question today, so let's move on. And we are not doing that. Some of the people running for office and school board are actually really focusing on that. And that is one of the things, no matter what else we do, and these other things are very critical too, don't get me wrong, but we have to have people who understand that, who understand what activism really is. And I want to end by saying something else. I would love you, I've said this several times on the Vic Society, to have a program in which, for example, the special ed program, one of the reasons that program has decreased and become more problematic is because about 12 years ago or so, the governor of this state, when he first came to office, worked it so that he wanted to reduce significantly public services, especially when the disability community was deinstitutionalizing. They always want to figure out how to do it cheaply. So when that didn't happen, there was a wonderful system put in place to actually follow every single person who had a disability in a very meaningful way. Interdisciplinary means a very, very, and I was in there, so I can tell you. Then about, this is going to sound like a long time, they won for about 30 years, and then the current governor just wiped it out. So when you have these things and you don't have the kind of double-edged supports, and that's just my word, but it's like, you know, you have the school doing their thing, but then you have the outside world also working with them to help with some of the workload, you have a problem. So we have done things that have been counter to helping something happen, like parent, we educate a lot of these parents and organize them. That needed help. You can't just have a district who is working on education all the time also do all the organizing. Okay. There's knowledge you have to share with parents. It's not a 1, 2, 3, go and do it yourself.
All right, Bonnie.
So that, all of that has to go into that. So thank you.
Yeah, Bonnie, thank you. Go ahead, Mercedes.
It's interesting because I keep, you know, I keep hearing that there's people who are running for school board who are talking about organizing parents, but the reality is that's already being done. Because of Citizen Action and our allies, we got the new code of conduct passed in the district. This year, we helped to make sure that so restorative practices were put back in the budget. And this is all because I am a parent of the district. I run an education committee that is parents of the district, and we organized and fought against it. Yes, I do believe that it needs to grow, but I think if we're talking about people, again, who are running for school board, who are saying that it needs to happen, it's being done. So I think it's important to see if they're saying that, what is their track record? What have they done? And and see how they're working with other people already.
So I've got a lot of phone calls and emails, and we're just going to kind of squeeze and keep going here. So if we come to you, try to keep it moving as best we can. Aaliyah in Rochester next. Go ahead, Aaliyah.
Hi, I was calling in regards to a comment that was earlier on. I think in Rochester we tend to have this narrative that we're the poorest city of this size and so on and so forth. And I think that it would be helpful to have a narrative that is more empowering to our children and to the people whom we're trying to help. I also dispute the narrative that if you go to a city school, like you're just going to be another statistic. You're going to end up pregnant, so on and so forth. I graduated from Edison. I went on to RPI. I have an engineering degree. I'm doing fine. I think we have to start talking in a more positive light. Like you're not empowering the children at all if we keep spinning this narrative and we keep telling them that they're not going to amount to anything. That's all you're going to get.
Aaliyah, thank you. I mean, I think she's referring, Joe Klein, to your comments earlier that, you know, if a child had gone to a youth prep versus a child going to different city schools, the outcomes would be different. Go ahead.
And, I mean, I was on the steering committee at Edison, and there were a few kids who did very well, and RPI is a great school. Congratulations. But in general, Edison is not preparing many of the kids to go to college, to get the sort of high-wage jobs. We actually started a program, a machining program at Edison. And these kids, machining companies were lined up to start probably at $18 to $20-an-hour jobs, and the district destroyed the program. So,
What you're saying sounds kind of like you're creating a narrative that students who go to city school are going to fail, which is inaccurate.
It is inaccurate, but if you look at from, I think, 3 years ago, the college and career-ready graduation rate of minority kids was under, college and career-ready graduation rate was under 5%. So, yes, some are going to do great, and there are kids at school 23, at 58, at the honors program of 12, at SOTA, where there are more select teachers, and I mean, there are the schools that have some middle-class kids get better resources and better teachers.
I want to correct something I said earlier that I think was ungenerous to Joe when I mentioned that, you know, Joe supports the state takeover of the city school board because he blames the school board for years of just ineffective leadership, the educational problems. And I said, if you feel like that's true, then how do you not support also a state takeover of city council and the mayor's office because of continuing structural poverty? Joe's point is you connect poverty more to the school district.
Absolutely.
So if that's the case, I think there is sort of an intellectual consistency, and I'll give Joe that, though you did say you haven't thought all that much about the city leadership's impact on poverty.
I haven't, and the city leadership has tried to do something about it. And Bob Duffy tried, the mayor is trying now. Mm-hmm. I also agree with Mercedes, though, that I believe that too many of the resources are being put downtown, and I would love to see more resources put in the neighborhoods where poverty is a problem.
Well, let me ask Bruce Popper, because we've got about 6 minutes left here. Joe's talked a lot about how he sees the solutions, and he's been working on what he sees solutions for many years. What are the solutions you see to economic inequality? Because, again, if you're just joining us, the thesis that Nick Hanauer is working off of is that educational inequality is very real, but it is not the disease. It is the symptom of the larger disease, which is economic inequality. If you believe that, and I know you do, Bruce, what do you do to change that?
I think we need to hold the largest employers in this area to a higher standard than the upstate minimum wage. One of the greatest leaps that has happened for low-wage workers is the increase in the minimum wage, the fast food wage, the paid family leave, which is very good benefit to low-wage workers, so they don't lose their jobs with family situations. But those have all been legislative things.
Which also, by the way, if I can just jump in, supports families, right, in the ways that we're talking about and that are important for education. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I think, you know, we have some very large employers. U of R Medicine, University of Rochester, Rochester Regional are the two largest. I mean, right there you're capturing 50,000 jobs, many of which are low-wage jobs, especially in home care and nursing homes. So I think we start with the big not-for-profits that pay very high executive salaries but very low at the bottom end of the scale and say, we're not going to tolerate low wages anymore. You're going to have to bring up the bottom because that's the responsible thing to do. There are a lot of other employers. Some smaller cities have run living wage campaigns. That's another vehicle. I think the train's left the station on state legislation, so I think this is going to have to be private pressure. I think the mayor is leading on this question. So is Dr. McMickle. It's a loss to us that he's leaving Colgate and the area, but there are some very strong voices out there about that. I would raise one other question, though, about the school district and its relation to poverty. There was an era when job training and job skills were done by the companies, and they didn't rely on the public school system and the community college system to have people prep ready to walk into jobs. We do a whole lot of career ladder stuff, English as a second language, GED, prep for licensed practical nurse, college at Strong Memorial Hospital. It's a real model. At any given time, 15% of my members are in some adult education, and we have an agreement with the University of Rochester that it's on paid time, that if you're a housekeeper or a dietary worker at entry level or a person who is a recent immigrant with language challenges, you're going to class because we know that the success rate is based on your ability to be there as part of your work schedule. And there are models like that that other employers could do, or even expanding at the University of Rochester, which has this arrangement with our union, that would remediate that.
And let me just jump in 30 seconds then. Tie it back to Hanauer's point on education. You do all these economic reforms that you want, and what do you think happens in public schools?
Well, I think he adequately describes the fact that when you have a more prosperous community, you have a better school system, that it's a matter of resources. I mean, I think, we should see good performance out of East High School because University of Rochester, with a lot of resources, is crashing on that. But it's not scalable within the school district.
So if I can just state the point a little differently, just real quick. I mean, if you increase income, you stabilize families, and you're going to, even if you don't, I believe, change anything in the schools, you're going to increase the chances of student success. Now, again, I'm not saying don't work on schools, but that's how that piece works to me.
Okay.
So final thing for me, sorry. So I think, like, there's been a lot of conversation about wages itself because that's what was in the article. But, like, for me, I think we also need to talk about, like, the racial wealth gap. You know, people of color, households of color have not for like 30 years have lost like half of their wealth. And if we don't address like the wealth issues along with the wages, then I don't see much improving.
Okay. Very strongly agree.
Okay.
I guess, you know, I would say any citizen should be reading Dr. Aquino's indictment of the district. The other thing is the waste there is so great. One of the other legs that I'd like to see is a lot of more emphasis on the social, emotional, behavioral, and physical health of our children. there is so much money wasted in the district. We could be the national leader in helping our children.
And Erica Rosenberg, in 40 seconds, give us some things that you are thinking about. When you look at the data, what are the things that matter most as we talk about what works in fixing schools?
Yeah, what I've been thinking about as we're wrapping up here is that we didn't spend a lot of time talking about kind of, in some ways we did, but the structural components of the economy that don't work. I mean, one thing you didn't read out of the piece is that he states in October 2018, there were 1 million more job openings than job seekers, right? So we've been talking about the people that can't do the skills in the jobs because they don't have basic skills. But why aren't wages going up? This is something I don't understand very well, and I think there's many different factors playing in there. But why, if we need workers and people need jobs, why aren't wages going up to attract people into some of those jobs?
Okay.
So lots to think about.
A lot to think about and a lot to continue to work on, and could have been here all day with that. That's Erica Rosenberg, President and CEO of the Center for Governmental Research. Always good to have you. Thank you for taking the time to be here.
My pleasure.
Our thanks to Mercedes Phelan, organizer at Citizen Action of New York. Thank you, Mercedes.
Thank you, Evan.
Joe Klein, chairman of Klein Steel, and connected to a lot of different educational reform efforts here in this community. Thank you, Joe. Thanks for being back here.
Thanks for having me.
Bruce Popper, former vice president of 1199 SEIU and a member of the RMAPI steering committee. I would say community. Committee. Hi, Bruce. Goodbye. Thank you.
Bye, Evan.
More connections coming up.